Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
In 2011, I was involved in a controversy. When an academic tells you that they're involved in a controversy, that's kind of a cringe-making thing to say, right? Very low scale. But I was asked to write some things about whether I thought that it was morally permissible for a particular pro-life group who had been engaged in some sting operations against Planned Parenthood, right, to be doing what they were doing. And I argued that it was impermissible what they were doing because it involved lying. I argued that, I pointed out that lying had been considered intrinsically impermissible by St. Augustine, by St. Thomas Aquinas, and this was also the common position of the natural law tradition and the Catholic Church for at least 1,000 years. But it was clear at that time that the insights of Augustine and Aquinas had been lost. And so I started to work on a book that eventually became Lying and Christian Ethics, in which I argued that Augustine and Aquinas were in fact correct about lying. If you understand lying as an assertion, right, an affirmation of something that's contrary to what you believe, right? You affirm that something is true, contrary to what you actually think is true. That's what a lie is, and I argued that this is always wrong. Now, in a review of that book, one academic said that he thought it was interesting that on the one hand, I was arguing for a recovery of Aquinas and Augustine's views on lying, but that on the other hand, it was clear from some things that I said in passing in the book that I actually disagreed with Augustine and Aquinas where the question of the ethics of killing was concerned. Why did I dissent from their views on that topic, but not from their views on lying? And an important part of the reason for this difference is that I saw, and continue to see, I think, in Augustine and Aquinas' views on killing, something that I did not see in their views about lying, namely a tension between a domain in which their views on the ethics of a particular kind of action are absolute, right, and a domain in which their views are rather permissive, right? So in the ethics of killing, right, their ethics are absolute with regard to, as I'll explain in just a minute, private killing, but are more permissive when it comes to public killing. But in the ethics of lying, their views are absolute across the board, right? So they just say flat out, lying is always wrong, it doesn't matter who you are, right? You could be a king trying to pursue political ends, or you could be a pauper trying to make ends meet. Lying is wrong no matter who you are. But their ethics of killing, right, what we could call the natural law ethics of killing, is divided. So on your first handout, you have a passage from Augustine in his Epistle 47 to Publicola, who wrote, quote, "As to killing others in order to defend one's own life, I do not approve of this, unless one happened to be a soldier or public functionary acting not for himself, but in defense of others or of the city in which he resides, if he act according to the commission lawfully given him and in the manner becoming his office." So here, Augustine sharply distinguishes between private citizens who are to kill, right, even in self-defense, and those who have public authority or political authority who can legitimately wield the sword, even lethally, in order to meet their responsibilities to protect the realm. And this view, naturally enough, extends also to Augustine's views, treatment of capital punishment, right, which is a further means by which civil authorities can do justice within the earthly city. And maybe I'll just mention, I'm just going to lose the glasses here, that Augustine also thought, and this is a slightly different tension and not one that I'm going to explore, that it was the special responsibility of Christian ministers to urge mercy on those with public authority when they were considering cases of people who had been charged with capital offenses. But in any event, there is, in Augustine's view, right, and we'll see that this is true of Aquinas too, there's an asymmetry between how private persons are situated with regard to the ethics of killing and how public persons are situated with regard to the ethics of killing. So the question that I want to ask is, must one accept that asymmetry? Or could one be justified in accepting what I'm going to call the absolute view on killing? This mirrors the view that I argue for in Lying and Christian Ethics when I argue for what I call the absolute view on lying, which is Augustine and Aquinas' view. Lying is always wrong, doesn't matter who you are, under what any circumstances. Right? Could one accept the absolute view on killing, the view that no one anywhere under any circumstance is morally permitted to intend the death of another human being? Right? So that notion of intention is important, and I'll come back to it. So my aim here tonight is to ascertain whether private persons, private citizens, and public officials are in fact symmetrically or asymmetrically situated in relationship to the norm about killing. And I'll present the beginnings of an argument that both private and public persons are in fact bound by the same absolute norm, right? That they are symmetrically related to this norm rather than asymmetrically, so that the ethics of private persons and public persons are different. And that is only the beginnings of an argument. It's going to be suggestive in certain places. I would urge you to purchase the full argument in the form that it will arrive in May or June in the book Killing and Christian Ethics, except that I'm confident that that's going to run over $100, and I would urge you just to wait until the library purchases it. Lobby for that, right? Get your library to get it. Okay, so I'm going to start with a brief discussion of the historical line of thought that leads up to the conclusion that they're asymmetrically situated. And this is the line running from St. Augustine's treatment of private killing to St. Thomas's treatment of murder in the Summa Theologiae. So St. Thomas asks in his discussion of murder, and this is in the second part of the second part, it's in question 64, article 7, which is in one of these volumes up here. We could get it if we need to. If we need more quotes, we can get more quotes, right? He asks whether it's lawful to kill another man in self-defense. And the first two objections that he raises come in the form of two apparent denials of that claim found in Augustine. And the first is the one that, again, we've already read from, but we'll just go through one more time from Epistle 47. Right? As to killing, this is again Augustine, as to killing others in order to defend one's own life, I do not approve of this, unless one happened to be a soldier or public functionary acting not for himself, but in defense of others or of the city in which he resides, if he act according to the commission lawfully given him and in the manner becoming his office. Right? So again, this distinction between the public and the private. Private citizen can't kill another even in order to defend his life, but a soldier or a public functionary may. Now, Augustine's claim about public officials will hardly seem unusual to us, right? We're used to the claim that public authorities do, in fact, legitimately take the life of other human beings. But the claim about private persons, right, is likely to appear novel, and I'm going to come back to that novelty a little bit later. One possible explanation for Augustine's thinking on this can be found in the second passage that Aquinas discusses from Augustine when he's discussing whether it's permissible to kill in self-defense. And this is from Augustine's On the Free Choice of the Will, where Augustine seemingly agrees with his interlocutor, Evodius. Evodius's claim is that things which can be taken against our will from us, like life, should be held in little esteem. Right? That is, if something can be taken away from you against your will, that you shouldn't really care very, very much for it. Right? It's therefore wrong to kill for their sake. And Augustine replies, quote, how indeed are they free of sin in the eyes of divine providence? That is, people who kill in their own defense. They have been stained with human blood for the sake of things, namely their own life, that should be held of little worth. Right? Unlike, for instance, your virtue, which cannot be taken away from you by somebody else against your will. Only you, right, can abdicate your virtue by acting and choosing wrongly. Right? But your life can be taken just as your property can, and Augustine seems to think that means that you should hold it in little esteem. Now, St. Thomas, in his discussion of self-defense, takes the killing that is prohibited, that Augustine is saying is prohibited, to private citizens, he understands that to be intentional killing, right? Which is, again, precisely the kind that I think is picked out by the absolute view of killing, which says that it's always wrong to intend another human being's death, right? And in one of the most famous and influential passages of the Summa, St. Thomas writes, and this is also on your handout, I think this is the second passage on your handout, nothing hinders one act from having two effects, only one of which is intended, while the other is beside the intention. Now, moral acts take their species according to what is intended, and not according to what is beside the intention, since this is accidental, as explained above. Accordingly, the act of self-defense may have two effects. One is the saving of one's life, the other is the slaying of the aggressor. Therefore, this act, since one's intention is to save one's own life, is not unlawful, seeing that it is natural to everything to keep itself in being as far as possible. So in the act of defending yourself, there might be two effects, right? One of which is the saving of your life, the other of which is the slaying of the aggressor. And if the slaying of the aggressor is outside the intention, right, then it's not going to be a violation of this norm that he takes Augustine to have established. Now, St. Thomas goes on to say that the defensive act must not be, quote, out of proportion to the end. So, for example, it would be wrong to bring about death if an act which would merely wound would suffice, right? If somebody is coming after me, if Olivia is coming after me, and I could defend myself only with an act that wounded, right, it would be wrong to kill in self-defense. And I don't think this is quite the same as the full-blown requirement that the principle of double effect eventually has articulated within it, right, that the good effect be proportionate to the bad effect. Right? We get this articulated in later developments of the tradition. But I do think, right, that St. Thomas is here articulating for the first time the fundamentals of what comes to be called the doctrine or the principle of double effect. And here's my summary formulation, right? The simplest formulation, I think, of that doctrine that's possible. Something that would be always wrong if it were intended. Right? Here's something that if you intended this, always wrong, isn't necessarily wrong, right, if the evil is not intended. Although it might be wrong if other conditions aren't met. So, for instance, the proportionality requirement. Let's say intentional killing by me of Olivia, always wrong. Okay, but the killing might not be wrong if it is outside my intention, right? If it's only what comes to be called a side effect. Okay, and if other conditions of proportionality are met. Okay, this, I think, this is the summary form of St. Thomas's, what eventually emerges from St. Thomas, the full-blown doctrine of double effect. Now, interestingly, Aquinas also interprets Augustine as holding the same view, right? And he points to the, what he thinks of as intentional language in these passages from Augustine. So in the first, the one that you have quoted from Epistle 47, Augustine says that what he doesn't approve of is killing another in order to, right, save one's life. Right, so that in order to for St. Thomas is an indication that the killing is intended, right? Because for St. Thomas, right, you have the end that you seek in your action, right? That's part of what you intend, right? Maybe the primary part of what you intend, but there's also the means by which you seek to bring about that end, and those means are also intended, right? What's our sort of paradigmatic expression for indicating that something is a means? It's this in order to expression. I did this in order to achieve that other thing. And so when Augustine is saying that it's wrong to kill somebody in order to save one's life, Aquinas interprets that as saying, what Augustine is ruling out here, right, is intending death. In the second of the passages, the one from on the free choice of the will, right, Augustine speaks of those who are stained with blood for the sake of these things, that is, for the sake of the defense of their life. And for the sake of is also obviously an expression that indicates your intention, right? What is it that you're trying to achieve for the sake of? So in both cases, St. Thomas suggests, what's impugned by Augustine is killing as a means to self-defense and not simply the use of lethal force. Okay. Now, many people, right, are perplexed by the idea that force could be used in self-defense, right? So the claim is this, right? Adam, right, might be attacking me, and I can use force, even lethal force, in defense of myself, right, without intending, in the case of lethal force, his death, right? And people find that a perplexing claim, right? How is it that I can foresee that my defense of myself is going to be lethal without intending that lethality, right? How is it also, right, that it might be the case that when he's attacking me, right, and my use of force is immediately physically forced upon him, right, I make contact with his body, foreseeing that that particular kind of contact, right, will be lethal. How is it that that isn't a matter of what's intended, right? The weapon that I have that's available might be one that is like physically simultaneous, the use of it physically simultaneous with his death, as when I have a gun and I shoot Adam. Sorry, Adam. In defense, right? a limited number of names of people that I know here. So it's either Adam or Olivia. To be mean, Olivia's too good a sport. Adam, you know, I've known Adam longer. You're okay with that, right? Yeah. Okay. I mean, there's also Adam and Noah, who I just like met a couple hours ago, so you can't do that. Okay. So you might be a skeptic and say, how is it that I could possibly shoot somebody in self-defense and not be intending their death? Okay. So consider, here's what I want to consider, these two different actions, which I think manifest two different intentions. Okay. And we can see them by considering, we consider the nested chain of means, right, that I pursue in order to accomplish the end of my action. So in this case, shooting, right, in order that the physical force of the bullet repel the attacker, in order that his attack be thwarted, in order that my life be saved. Right? That's how I think of what Aquinas is suggesting here, right, that there can be use of force in self-defense without that use of force being intended as lethal, even if lethality is pursued. I'm using the force in order to repel the attack. And nowhere included in that chain is the death of the attacker, right, identified as a state of affairs from which I think I could benefit. Right? It's not necessary. Right? I'm using the force. Right? As long as that keeps him away and saves my life, then it's doing its work. Right? But that case is different from one in which I seek a benefit that really only could be brought about by the death. So here's a different act, right, that I think the structure of which is different and the intention is shown to be different. I administer potassium chloride in order to bring about death, right, of somebody who I think will be better off dead by way of the relief of their suffering. Right? So a case of assisted suicide or euthanasia of some sort. Right? There, the death really is sought as bringing about the benefit that I'm seeking, right? And you could think of a different example, right? My Uncle Henry has willed me $1 million, right? And the only way that I can get him is if he dies. And if I inject him with potassium chloride, it's pretty clearly the case that the means by which I plan to get the inheritance is his death. That seems to be different from the case where I'm defending myself against Adam's very inhospitable attack. I think this is important because I think it shows that you can follow the absolute norm against intending death while engaged in defense of your life. And that's an end that St. Thomas does rightly acknowledge as honorable. Right? If foreseeably inevitable or physically close causal consequences necessarily involved intending, right, those consequences, then it's very difficult to see how one could defend oneself against attack, right, save by some very different kind of approach to the ethics of killing. Okay. Now, on the one hand, right, what I've just done is defend St. Thomas against an objection that would be more restrictive. Okay? But I think also you need to defend St. Thomas from approaches that are more permissive, that interpret intention in ways that let you get away with things that I think you shouldn't get away with. Right? One in particular, and this will lead us to the next quotation on your handout, identifies what's intended only with the end. Right? So that even something might be a means, but if it's not your end, right, then it might be the case that you don't intend it, that it's not part of your intention. And of course, that would allow you to choose to kill somebody in order to defend your life, so long as the end that you were seeking was not that person's death, but that was only a means to saving your life. Right? And so here's Nigel Bigger, from whom the long quotation is from, right, arguing that it's important to distinguish between intending and choosing, right, in order to be able to defend a double effect analysis from the charge that it excuses agents from responsibility for their acts. And I'll come back to that in just a second. So here's the example. This is from a description, if you've ever read any of these books or seen the movie, from Patrick O'Brien's Master and Commander. Anybody ever? Russell Crowe movie, and also like a whole heap of books, okay? And this scene is in the movie. Right? So a ship is engulfed in a severe Atlantic storm. One of her masts is broken and crashes into the sea. The midshipman warns the captain that unless the ship is cut free from the fallen mast, it will drag her over and cause her to sink. But there is a dilemma, for clinging to the wrecked mast is a sailor who is blown over with it. If the ship is cut free from the wrecked mast, the sailor will, with practical certainty, drown. The captain makes his decision. He calls for axes and orders another sailor standing nearby to help him cut the ropes binding the ship to the fallen wreckage. The sailor happens to be the best friend of the fellow clinging to the wreckage, and as he lifts his axe and brings it down on the ropes, tears stream down his cheeks. The sailor with the axe knew what he was doing. He knew that he was performing an act that would help to cause his friend to drown. He could have disobeyed orders and refused to cut the ropes, but he did not refuse. He chose to obey. Did he therefore intend to kill his friend? To give an affirmative answer would, I think, imply that the sailor was intent upon killing his friend, that is what he wanted. Such an implication would be entirely inappropriate. What he was intent upon, what he wanted, was to save the ship and its crew by the only means possible. The death of his friend was entirely unwanted, as his streaming tears bear witness. In this case, then, it seems appropriate to say that in choosing to cut the ropes, the sailor intended the effect of saving the ship, but that he only accepted with deepest reluctance the effect of causing his friend to drown. Right? Now, that sounds a lot like my analysis too, right? That he accepts the drowning of his friend, right? And that's how I would analyze this. He seeks to save the ship. He's going to save the ship by cutting away the mast, right? And it's a consequence of cutting away the mast and a side effect, not part of his intention, that the sailor will drown. Okay, that seems very plausible, right? And in that way, Bigger's point seems identical to mine, right? The sailor's death is accepted but not intended. But, right, I think I have this quotation on your handout as well. This is Bigger's conclusion. His friend's death was quite beside his intention, and then this is the key claim, even though he chose it. What this analysis reveals is that intention is not just about deliberate choice, but also about desire, not just about willing, but also about wanting. An effect that I intend, therefore, is one that I both choose and want, and an effect that I accept is one that I choose but do not want. Right? So on Bigger's analysis, a chosen means is not intended if it's not also wanted. So let me just back up and sort of describe the difference of this position between mine and Bigger's, and I think between Thomas's and Bigger's. Right? Intention, again, encompasses the end that you're seeking. Right? Bigger and I agree on that. Right? The end, Thomas Aquinas will often say, is intended, whereas the means is chosen. And that leads some people to think that there's a distinction between means and ends where Aquinas is thinking about intention. But Aquinas also says that means are intended. And that makes sense because many means are themselves proximate ends that one needs to seek in order to bring them about, in order to bring about what you further desire, okay, what you further want. So for me, on my view, on Aquinas' view, I think, right, intention encompasses both the end and the means that are pursued, right, that are chosen in Aquinas' language in order to achieve that end. Right? For Bigger, intention is what you're seeking as an end and what you choose as a means when you want what's chosen as a means, right? And he infers, right, that although this guy in the story from Patrick O'Brien's novel is choosing to kill his friend, right, although he's choosing in order to save the ship, he doesn't intend it because he doesn't want his friend's death, as you can infer from the tears streaming down his eyes. So on Bigger's view, he's choosing to kill, but he doesn't intend to kill because he does not want the death of that person. Okay. Now, I don't think Bigger has two reasons for thinking of this, right? One is that he thinks that any other analysis is going to create problems for assigning responsibility, right? I don't think that's the case, right? But I also don't think that this is a plausible account of the intention of this person who is cutting down with the axe, right? It's not plausible because, as Bigger himself acknowledges, this language of not wanted, right, is ambiguous. Right? Between not emotionally desired and not rationally willed. Right? We can speak of somebody as not wanting something when emotionally they are averse to it, right? Even though they think that it needs to be done, right? Or we can think of something as not wanted when they don't rationally choose, right? They don't rationally adopt it as means. One rationally wills something as a means only insofar as one takes it as needful for the achievement of one's end. And in this case, right, as in the cases of Aquinas' self-defense, the death of that sailor doesn't need to be understood by the agent as in any way needful for the achievement of his end. Right? He would do exactly the same thing even if that person, if the sailor was not on hanging on the end of the mast, right? He would still cut it away, right? The death of the sailor doesn't accomplish anything for him. And so it's very implausible to say that it's rationally willed. Okay. And if it's very implausible to say that it's rationally willed, it seems to me that it's utterly implausible to say that it's chosen. We choose what we take to be needful with regard to our ends. So I think it's true to say that the axe-wielding sailor does not intend the death of his friend, right? But I think it's also correct and necessary to say that he did not choose it. Now, in this particular case, Baker and I come to the same conclusion, so it might seem like, what's the big deal, right? This is academics arguing about a novel. Well, what could be more fun than that, okay? But I think there are actually important consequences. If you look at Bigger's Ethics of War and at some of the work that's been done by people who follow Bigger's ethics, right? Here I think is a traditional part of the natural law ethic of killing, that it's always wrong to intend the death of innocents in warfare, of non-combatants in warfare. Okay? Now I think that's what was done, for instance, in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Right, I think non-combatants were intentionally killed in order to hasten the end of the war, right? And so I think that that is wrong. I think that's what Aquinas would think as well. Okay, but all that Bigger needs to say, right, or people who follow Bigger's analysis, in order to say that the deaths of the people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the citizens in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, were not intended, right? He can say, yes, the Allies chose to kill those civilians in order to bring about the end of the war, but they didn't want their death. Right? Emotionally, they were averse to it. They weren't happy about it. Okay? And that's enough to say that those deaths were not intended, and therefore they're not ruled out by the absolute norm against intentionally killing civilians. Right? That just seems to be very implausible. To say that it's enough that you don't intend something, that you don't actually want it in this kind of desiring or emotional sense, that just seems very plausible. Right? Probably everybody here, I don't want to speak for you. Right. It is true of me that on occasion I have done things, right, that I should not have done, right, while really wishing that I wasn't doing those things. And that, unfortunately, does not seem enough to say that I didn't intend to do the things. We're not going to get into further details about that. But I think that's a plausible claim. So I think that we should accept St. Thomas's claim that lethal force can be used in self-defense without intending death or harm. Okay, just to say, it's a plausible claim. I think it's Thomas is exactly right in thinking that one can defend oneself, right, against an attacker, right, even lethally, right, without that death being intended, and hence without it being ruled out by the norm that he takes Augustine to have been articulating. Okay. But then here's the question that I want to ask. Why think the double effect can only be applied to or should only be invoked with regard to private citizens? What rationale can there be for treating the case of private and public persons differently? Right? So we're back to this question of the asymmetry that I mentioned earlier. Why think that what is impermissible for private persons to intend, right, and that you have to treat with double effect reasoning, is permissible for people with public authority to intend and doesn't therefore require double effect reasoning? Now, one obvious reason for thinking that the two cases are different concerns the nature of the task that people with public authority have or are required to meet. Public officials serve the common good in a way that individual citizens need not and normally do not. Moreover, they serve it in a way that insulates them from some of the factors that can make private actions for the same ends unreasonable. So consider again Augustine's concerns in the letter to Publicola. Augustine writes, this is not, I think, on your passage, on your handout. He says, the precept, resist not evil, right? Don't intend death in defense of yourself, was given to prevent us from taking pleasure in revenge, in which the mind is gratified by the sufferings of others, but not to make us neglect the duty of restraining men from sin, right? So on Augustine's thought, this way of dividing up the territory, right, so that private persons can't defend themselves lethally, prevents them from sinning, right, by desiring the death of people, right, while also enabling the common good to be pursued and peace and stability to be pursued by people with public authority, right? There's the duty to restrain people from sin. Those with public authority meet that duty. So there's two needs, Right? One is that human beings be restrained from sin, and then a second, that people not act from unrighteous motivation. Right? I think if I was being attacked by somebody, right, it would be hard not to hate that person. I think Augustine is alive to this possibility. But the institution of public law and its instruments, including its officers, such as the police, I think is the most plausible way, I agree with Augustine, it's the most plausible way of accomplishing these ends together. Those who act under the law act under its impersonal guidance on behalf of the state. Both guided by the law and serving as the law's instruments, they're thus insulated from some, although only some, of the inducements to act from revenge, hatred, bias, and so on, that would be prominent were individuals to be the potentially lethal judges of other individuals. If I had to be the judge of my own case against Adam when he's brought to trial, right, for having grievously attacked me, right, it would be hard for me to restrain my anger at having been invited down to the University of Florida in order for him to bring this attack against me. But if I'm operating under the demands of the law and have no connection to the case, anybody who's got a connection recused from it, right, and I'm guided by procedures that are impersonal and universal, right, as the law aspires to be, right, then the thought is that insulates me from some of the motivations that would otherwise warp my practical thinking in coming to a determination about whether somebody was guilty and what the reasonable punishment would be. So public officials, such as judges or police, who we're talking about primarily right now, right, public officials have a task that's different from private citizens. Right? On Augustine's view, he describes that as restraining men from sin, although we could maybe provide a more nuanced account of the ends of political governance. Right? They've got a different task, right, promoting the common good, and institutional features governing how they serve that task makes it possible for them, in principle, to act more fairly and discriminately than it makes sense to expect of private citizens, right, fallen human beings. In consequence, it seems that public officials really are capacitated to use force to a greater extent, that is, in more situations, and in greater measure than our private individuals. Right? It seems to me that Augustine and Aquinas' distinction between private and public makes sense so far forth. Right? There are some things that it would be wrong for individuals to do, right, because they can't do them without wrongful motivations creeping in, that the authority and institutional structure of people with public authority, right, makes potentially possible to do in a more reasonable way. And I think this is certainly true where punishment is concerned. Right? The general rule for private persons, for private citizens, is they cannot punish other citizens in ways that use force. Right? Within a business or a church or a family, various forms of discipline and punishment may be exerted. Right? You can kick somebody out of the house, or you can tell somebody that they're excommunicated, or you can fire somebody, right? But always short of the force that's used by the state and its agents in apprehending, trying, and punishing criminals, right? Because the reason for this, I think, is straightforward. Allowing private individuals to punish with the sword would be to invite great injustices from those individuals. And similarly, police are entitled to a use of force that goes beyond what citizens are entitled to use. Citizens aren't to go after fleeing felons, planning to apprehend them forcibly if necessary, while police are expected to do just that. Right? Or consider the difference between the permissible use of force by a police officer who's pulled you over and that by a private citizen, even if he pulls you over for exactly the same reason. You've got a broken taillight. Right? The circumstances under which the private citizen can use force if you're being belligerent, right? I pulled you over and you're giving me a hard time. Right? The circumstances in which I can use force against you are very different from the circumstances that would justify a police officer in using force if you're being belligerent after you've been pulled over. And it doesn't seem like we could afford to have police who are charged with upholding public peace and order without expecting them to use some degree of force in doing so, a degree of force beyond that which private citizens are reasonably expected to use. Right? There would be no order if police weren't expected to use some force. There would be radical disorder if individual private citizens were all entitled to use the same amount of force that the police are entitled to use. So, there's reasons, I think, to agree with Augustine and Aquinas that private and public individuals are differently situated with regard to the entitlement to use force. Right? That's the key point that I want to say. There is an asymmetry with regard to the use of force. Public authorities have a greater entitlement to its use than private persons. But this entitlement need not bring with it an entitlement to intend harm or death. It could be the case that while the police are entitled to use a greater degree of force and to use it with greater latitude and scope than private citizens, nevertheless, even the use of force by the police should be governed by the norm against intentional killing. Force would be used with the intent to subdue, restrain, stop, prevent, and the like, but without the intent to kill. Where intending death was concerned, it could be that police and private persons are on exactly equal footing. Right? There is an asymmetry, but it doesn't have to do with intending death. It only has to do with permissible use of force. Now this thought, right, the thought that private persons and public authorities should be on the same footing, right, where intention is concerned, right, I think actually is a natural thought. And my guess is that if you were surveyed before coming in here, right, you actually would have, many of you would have articulated exactly this thought, and that certainly the vast majority of people on this campus, right, the vast, vast majority would agree with that claim under that description, right, that where intending death is concerned, private persons and public persons are not asymmetrically related in the way that Augustine and Aquinas thought, especially Aquinas. But, right, that view that there shouldn't be this asymmetry leans most people, right, that 99.99% of the people, to think that public and private persons are equally entitled to use lethal force as a matter of what they intend, at least as far as defense is concerned. Right? Very few people think that it's wrong for a private person to intend death when they're defending themselves against an unjust attack. Right? Most people, just put this in another way without the negatives, most people think, right, that if Adam is attacking me, right, I cannot just use force that I anticipate and foresee will be lethal, but that I can intend the lethality in defending myself against Adam. I think this is the view that most people have, including most Catholics. Right? Some time ago, a couple years ago, maybe not even a couple years ago, a drunken student, well, two different stories, right? Within a couple of months of each other, a drunken student tried to break his way into a house in our neighborhood because he was at the wrong house, and the people within the house shot him to death, right, through the door. And a few weeks later, a drunken student tried to break into my daughter's house. And she doesn't own a gun, and we were able to call the police, and he was carted away. But I said to him, people get killed for this, right? And I think people intend the deaths that they bring about in many of these cases when they're shooting people in what they take to be self-defense. So Augustine and Aquinas' teaching, right, that it's wrong for private persons to intend death, I think has basically been abandoned, right? And quietly abandoned because many people are just not aware that that's their view. The view seems so natural and so intuitively obvious to many people that they express puzzlement that anyone could deny it. It's a mystery to them how one could think that it's not morally permissible to intend the death of someone who is unjustly attacking you. By contrast, I think the arguments in favor of its being permissible for private persons even, right, to intend death in self-defense are weak. And so in what follows, I'm going to discuss two such arguments. Once rebutted, it will be seen that there's good reason for thinking that private citizens should not intend the death of an attacker. And while public officials are entitled to a greater reliance on force than private citizens, right, that doesn't entail necessarily an entitlement to intend death. So the position that both private and persons should be thought of as symmetrically situated with regard to the use of intentionally lethal means, I hope, will gain in plausibility. Yet again, both Augustine and Aquinas accepted that asymmetry, and so in concluding the talk, right, after looking at these two arguments, I'm going to suggest a possible reason why. Okay, so consider the most intuitively plausible justification for holding the persons, public or private, may intend death when acting in self-defense. And that's that human persons have a right to such defense. And that right involves an entitlement to intend death. I think the first part of this claim is true, and it seemed true to Thomas Aquinas as well. Human life is a basic good, It's a constituent part of our welfare. And as such, every agent has an obligation never to intentionally damage or destroy that life. And so every person, each of us here, has a right against every other agent that they not attempt to do such damage or destruction to their life. And moreover, you surely have a positive obligation to care for your life, right? Not just to, the good is not just a series of fence posts against other people, but requires obligations of you that you care for your life and you protect and promote it, right? Not to protect and promote your life would be to hold it cheap, right? And to fail to acknowledge the goodness of your life and its motivating force. So we have ordinary obligations to make sure that we're reasonably healthy and to avoid unnecessary risks or risks for the sake of trivial gains, to exercise and things like that. And if we have such obligations, then it seems we likewise have certain rights to non-interference with regard to those obligations, right? I have an obligation to protect my life, right? And I couldn't really do that if I didn't have an entitlement to use, right, to protect it against people when they're unjustly attacking it. This seems like a fairly robust right, right? And so the combination of an absolute right against others intending my death and a strong right of non-interference that I have against you people from protecting my life, right, suggests that I'm justified in protecting it in the way that Aquinas thought, right, used with some degree of force. And Aquinas comes back to this idea more than once. He says, an intention to save one's life is not unlawful, seeing that it is natural to everything to keep itself in being, right, and that one is bound to take more care of one's own life than of another's. So I don't think he'd have any difficulty in saying, in a more modern idiom, that somebody has a right to self-defense. But I think this itself shows the failure of the argument from self-defense to justify intentional killing. For that right can be upheld by means of a use of force in which the killing lies outside the intention. You can exercise your right to self-defense in a way that doesn't involve intending the death of your attacker in order to be effective. Right? And so again, the right to self-defense does not imply a right to intend the death of the person who's attacking. Now, a second claim that I am going, in the interest of time, to just say something very, very quick about and then move on, right, is that the attacker, in being unjust, somehow gives up, right, their right against your intending their death. Right? And Aquinas does have, there are thoughts to this effect in his work, that a sinner, right, by virtue of sinning, loses the dignity that's proper to them as a human person and descends to the level of beasts, and that this is part of the justification for why it can be permissible for somebody with public authority to take their life. Right? But Aquinas also says things that are in tension with that. Right? He says things to the effect that the nature that is in each of us is a nature that God loves and that has intrinsic value, and that as such, right, in itself, it's wrong to act against. Right? And I think, right, if you carry that thought out to its furthest point, that you get something like the claim that Pope John Paul makes in his encyclical Evangelium Vitae, right? If your dignity, what we could call that your dignity or your excellence and your inviolability depends on your nature as a human person, that's obviously not lost in sinning. And if it's not lost in sinning, then neither is your inviolability from intentional harm from another. And so John Paul in Evangelium Vitae says, not even a murderer loses his personal dignity, and God himself pledges to guarantee this. Right? I think this is making a solid point, right? And one, again, that there's tension in Thomas Aquinas with respect to. Now, I want to conclude, right, by saying something about this tension now, right, this asymmetry that we started with has now resolved itself, it seems to me, into a tension of two sorts, right? One is a claim about the dignity of the human person, okay? And that claim about dignity, I think, can be used to generate a claim of inviolability against intending death or harm. And on the other are these claims that we've had recourse to about the authority of somebody who's charged with caring for the common good. Aquinas and Augustine both speak of the dignity of the human person, and Aquinas speaks of that dignity is attendant upon human nature, right? So it seems plausible that it can't be lost, right, save by death. He speaks of human life as a good and identifies the principle directing to that good as one of the principles of the natural law, one of the first principles, right? That life as a good is also attendant upon our human nature, and it seems plausible that nothing short of death could change that. And these thoughts clearly underlie at least a part of Aquinas' willingness to countenance intentional killing by private persons, right? It's part of this like this whole cluster of notions of life being intrinsic good and of human persons having dignity and being loved by God, right, that formed part of the rationale of the norm against private persons intentionally killing other persons. So why does Aquinas change gears in his discussion of public officials who he clearly holds canon 10 death when acting on behalf of the state? So here, just a couple of concluding thoughts that are not an argument, but just a sort of suggestion about how to think about what's going on here. The philosopher Joseph Boyle, late philosopher Joseph Boyle, suggested that in the natural law and Christian traditions more generally, and in Augustine and Aquinas in particular, that they look at the issue of killing through two different lenses. Through one of those lenses, they primarily have in their sights the human person as a being who's made in the image and likeness of God, and thus possessed of a unique status among all the created beings of this earth. So let's call this the dignity approach, or the dignitarian approach. The other lens, right, which you also find through the tradition, is one through which the property of authorization, right, and authority to act on behalf of the common good appears to be of overriding importance. And so we could call this the authority approach. I think that through the lens of the dignity approach, human life tends to appear inviolable. And through the lens of the authority approach, that inviolability is overshadowed by the power of authority and ultimately by the power of divine authority. And there's obvious reasons, I think, in the tradition why authority gets such emphatic consideration. One, which I've already discussed, is the fact that those with public authority have a different task from private citizens, namely responsibility for the common good. And in some published and unpublished writings of Elizabeth Anscombe, she uses that, the task that public authorities have, as the justification, right, for why they have an entitlement to intend death. That responsibility, I've argued, clearly requires greater entitlement to use force, but the distinction between that entitlement and an entitlement to intend death, I think, is easily obscured. Indeed, it seems to me only with Aquinas' introductions of the fundamentals of the doctrine of double effect does it become possible to adequately even distinguish those two entitlements from each other, an entitlement to use force and an entitlement to intend death. Scriptural reasons, I think, obviously provide the second reason for the emphasis on authority. Killing appears in many Old Testament passages, especially to be authorized in a way that derives from divine authority. When that's the case, the killing is not simply authorized, but is obligatory. Moreover, God himself is the ultimate authority, and his majesty and power have a tendency to swamp awareness of and concern for the dignity of the person and concern for human life. Nevertheless, there's a tension both in Scripture and in Christian tradition, and in Aquinas' natural law account as well, between these two approaches. The more one concentrates on the imago Dei, the dignity of the person, the goodness of human life, the more inviolability of life seems like it should provide a check on all possible forms of authority such that no one is authorized to intend death. On the other hand, the more one focuses on authority, and especially the majesty and power of divine authority, the less it will seem like the dignity of the human person grounds a strong inviolability claim. And indeed, through the lens of authorization, the clarity with which human dignity is seen begins to be obscured. Now, this brief account of the tension between these two ways of thinking about the ethics of killing provides no argument, but only a frame within which to see why and how this particular dispute over the ethics of killing currently exists among thinkers within the Thomistic natural law Catholic tradition. Some such thinkers are convinced that the scriptural passages appearing to show, that there are divinely authorized killings do not, in Boyle's words, really represent God's revelation. On the other hand, many others find the account of human authorization and divine authorizing of intentional killing to be both plausible and necessary for making sense of Scripture and tradition. My own understanding of the natural law ethics of killing fits within the first of these patterns. I reject the claim that some are authorized to intend death for three reasons. First, an argument from the intrinsic value of human life and the unalienable dignity of human persons leaves no room for an authorization to kill. Its conclusion is, and I think must be, framed as a moral absolute with no exceptions, so the absolute view on killing. Second, the specific arguments for an authorization to kill seem to me weak. Right, we've seen three so far, namely the argument from the task of political authority, the argument from the right to defense, and the argument from a loss of one's personal dignity. All three are extended in St. Thomas's discussion of capital punishment, which I can't consider here in detail. But lying behind all such discussions and arguments is the question of God's authority and his relationship to the good of human life. So I close with one final thought, right, and a further idea that I think also has a place in Thomas's work, that God's love for human beings and his constant will of their good is incompatible with the idea that God himself ever intends the death of human beings. God is not the author of death in the sense of intending it, and hence, right, works against the idea that he could ever, in fact, authorize others to intend to take human life. And I think for that ground, on that ground, right, the ground of God's love for human beings and for the intrinsic value of their human lives, we should reject the claim that there's an asymmetry in the natural law between the ethics of private killing and of public killing. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.